Let's bow together. Gracious God, our Father in heaven, we thank you once more for the privilege of coming together to study how to be better proclaimers and teachers of thy word. Help us, Father, as we study these lessons, to work hard to put them into practice so that we may do more for thy kingdom and contribute more to the edification and the spiritual maturity of thy people. We're privileged, Father, for the opportunity to serve. In Jesus' name, amen. Last Lord's Day, we closed by talking about the elocution movement, which basically said that there's one way to stand, there's one way to gesture, and there's one way to sound. And if you didn't have that down and follow that rule, you weren't going anywhere as a public speaker, because that's what people expected. And that's what they wanted you to bring to the lectern. Fortunately, as we found for us in the modern day, those rules no longer apply. But what is being used today is what is called the natural method or the conversational style, where we learn to talk as we commonly talk, as we talk in conversation one with another. And that really emphasizes, I think, the definition of preaching, which also applies to teaching, that Phillips Brooks gave in a book that he wrote on preaching. But as I say, it applies to teaching as well. And basically what he said was, and this is a paraphrase, that it is God's truth presented through personality. And that's a paraphrase. If you want it word for word, I think it's preaching is the presentation of the gospel to man by man. And that's what we get in a classroom situation. When we talk about speaking and conversational style, it is really related to what we would do in talking to one another out in the hall before or after class, or sitting here as the class or before the class begins, or walking across to the auditorium after class is over. It's just the way people talk to one another. Now, that does not mean that the lesson is presented exactly like you would behave in one-on-one conversation, unless we recognize that even in one-on-one conversation, the speaker's fervor in even that conversation increases in relationship to the number of persons that may be surrounding that conversation or a part of that conversation. And it affects the intensity. The subject matter can affect the intensity that even in one-on-one conversation we bring to the conversation itself. Well, how is this conversational style achieved? Number one, sounds strange for a conversation, where that word speaks of talking. But number one, you listen. You listen to others. You listen to yourself. And when you speak one-on-one, you gesture. I have never been in a conversation with anybody, even somebody who is bashful, who stands there like this in a one-on-one conversation. It just doesn't happen. You're relaxed. You're just talking in natural style. And so as you do, the gestures just naturally happen. As a matter of fact, if you're in a one-on-one conversation, you can't help but gesture. You're going to do it or look stupid. And the reason that doesn't happen is because nobody in a one-on-one conversation talks without gesturing. You do it because it's natural. When you speak one-on-one, doesn't your voice rise and fall depending on what you're saying and what's going on in the conversation and the subject that's being used or talked about in the conversation? Your voice rises, your voice falls, you gesture naturally, and that's what conversational teaching is all about. I don't think any one of you has ever been in a one-on-one conversation where right in the middle of it, you thought, I need to get louder here, or I need to get softer here. It just occurs naturally because you're talking with people, you're communicating with people, and that is the way we communicate. If conversational style then is so easy, sort of like talking over a kitchen table, and that's a common term. All the politicians talk about the kitchen table conversations where people are talking about the problems of the day and things that they need or things that they wish would happen. It's sort of like talking over a backyard fence. If that's so easy, then why is it so difficult to achieve it in the classroom? Could the answer be intimidation? After all, in a classroom, everybody in that room is looking at the teacher. Oh, they're all looking at me. Well, you know, I understand that with this teacher that's very difficult to do. I may start giving glasses or something. But everybody in the classroom is watching the teacher, the teacher's every move, listening to every word. Well, surely this requires something different than what you're going to have just sitting in a kitchen around a kitchen table or standing out here just talking to somebody. It's got to require something different in the classroom. But even if it doesn't call for something different, and it doesn't, it very often produces something different. The hearer's fixed attention affects the teacher. It's sort of like a snake's hypnotic stare at its prey. That prey is sitting there as if it's paralyzed. It doesn't know what to do or how to do it until it's dinner. And then it has no choice about what's going to happen. And very often, when you got a classroom out there looking at you and listening to you, you become the rabbit, they become the snake, and it robs us of our ability to just act naturally, how we would act ordinarily. The greatest challenge to effective communication for the teacher is for the teacher to maintain a style that is natural to him instead of developing characteristics that are atypical, are not typical of that individual. Since even the most experienced teacher, including yours truly, can experience some intimidation when he faces a class, then what hope is there for the rest of us? How can a teacher in a pressure cooker be natural? Well, by one thing about which we've already talked, and that's proper lesson preparation. Well, how does that reduce intimidation? Because while you're up here, you don't have to be worrying about what you're going to say or how you're going to say it, or what materials you're going to be covering. So it eliminates a worry, doesn't it, about what you're trying to accomplish and how you plan to accomplish it. Understanding guidelines for natural delivery helps because it eliminates worry about how best to behave as the teacher up here, how you're going to gesture, because you're not thinking about gesturing. I mean, when I was going over this lesson, I didn't say, Jess, now when you say you're not worrying about the lesson, I didn't say wave your hand here. But that's just the natural thing to do when you're talking about something like that. Ostentatious delivery, whether it's of the voice or gesture or vocabulary, distracts. Monotone delivery is the opposite end of the spectrum from ostentatious delivery. And what happens when we move in that direction instead of just being natural is that we draw attention to ourselves as a teacher. And when we draw attention to ourselves as a teacher, if anything's going to be remembered out of that class, it's going to be the teacher. And that's not what Bible study is about. And that's the reason that we need to just talk. Not, you know, in low language like you might if you just got talking to one person and you're just a yard apart. But I'm talking about the style that you use in talking. The teacher's goal always has to be to get out of the way of the message. Well, why is that? Because the true messenger always, at least attempts to hide behind the cross. And when we let our style become predominant, or we use the big words, or whatever it is, we draw attention to ourselves, and that's not what the teacher in Bible study should do. Well, public speaking in presentation has tools. You remember the tools I brought on preparation? All the books we looked at and the different books we need to have, the types of books we need to have. Well, what are the tools of the presentation? You've got two. The voice and gesture. The use of these tools is determined by the nature of the occasion, by the nature of the class, and the nature of the message. For instance, the occasion. I don't know how many of you came to the funeral of Matt Johnston. Jonathan had a part in the eulogy. The style that he used there is far different from the one that he uses on Sunday morning, has used, and will use this morning, I'm sure. But why? Because the occasion is different, and it called for a different style. The class, if I may use that term in relationship to that event, was there for a different purpose, and thus that made the message different. But when we are teaching, the use of each tool should be varied, should be appropriate, and should be purposeful. Purpose may dictate that certain standards of delivery will be employed, as we just described. It may dictate that certain standards of delivery may be ignored. It may even dictate that sometimes standards of delivery be broken or violated. But that's something that is determined. And if we really understand the nature of the occasion and the class and the message, then those are things that are going to occur naturally. Because we understand that. It's affected our entire approach to the preparation. And if it affects the preparation, why would it not affect the presentation? Now, there are some folks who consider that these rules are foreign to teaching. But I suggest to you that I said rules, I think I meant tools. I suggest to you that this will not be the attitude of those who wish to do their best in teaching the life-giving gospel to those who are in the class. Well, let's talk about the voice for a minute. Not every teacher is blessed with a great speaking voice. But fortunately, that is not an absolute requirement for effective teaching. A nasal twang, a raspy voice, a soft-spoken voice may, to some extent, be distracting, but it's not fatal. You have probably known, as I have known, teachers with all of those problems. Not one with all of them, but different people with those problems. And I have considered them to be great teachers. Well, why? How? Because the sincerity of the speaker has enabled the hearers to see past the voice to Jesus Christ. But having said that, we need to understand that a teacher with a poor voice should not neglect the development, trying to develop his voice, even though he may succeed without it. He owes it to himself, he owes it to his class, and he owes it to his Lord to become the best that he can be. I suppose that the methods of improving the voice, particularly when you come to professional help, can almost be dizzying. But there is one absolute rule that has to always be there. And that is, you have to have a voice that will go from where you are as the teacher to the back of the room, to the back of the auditorium, wherever it is that you're teaching. Because if the class does not hear, the class cannot learn. We always need those who are the farthest away to hear. I sometimes try to reduce my voice a little in this situation out of respect for the class next door. Because these walls are nice, but they are not soundproof. Doesn't mean you don't get loud sometimes. Because loudness can be effective if used properly. But surprise loudness jolts the adults and scares the children. And that's about it. Loudness for loudness' sake. But there always ought to be proper variety in volume, in tone, in pace. And you use those things to convey different thoughts and different feelings as you are making your presentation. It depends on what you're talking about, the subject matter, and the emphasis that you want to have upon it. Emphasis does not always mean volume. And when I say volume there, I'm talking about high volume. Sometimes it means that you use low volume, because you may have just really raised your voice and now you want to communicate something differently. There must always be variety in the use of the voice. Because if there is not, you wind up with something that is monotone. You wind up with something that is one volume. And if you want to lose your audience, that's a good way to do it. Delivery may vary from low and slow to high and fast, but it should always be suited to what the words mean. You're going to use different volume and you're going to use different speed. If you're talking about joy or sorrow or seriousness or humor or contemplation, I mean, your voice has to get across those thoughts or assist you in getting across those thoughts. And if you're up there spouting like this and talking about how happy people ought to be, well, what message are they going to get? Other than, you know, I don't like this class. The voice doesn't go with the subject matter. And that must always be done. Words of feeling that are spoken without feeling convey no emotion to the hearer. In fact, may convey nothing to the hearer. Well, what about the gestures? We've talked about them, but let's go into a little more detail. What a gesture means is that effective communication requires harmony between the spoken language and the body language. That's all it is. You always, when you are in front of a class, you have those two communications going on at all times. The spoken language and the body language. And if the spoken language and the body language are different, then your hearers are going to be confused. And you know what? More often than not, they'll believe the body language over the spoken language. That's why you don't scowl when you're talking about joy. That's why you don't smile when you're talking about the crucifixion. It's not appropriate to the spoken language. I used to have a practice when I'd come up and a parent would be holding, particularly the father, would be holding a baby, not a young baby, but, you know, able to talk, understand, maybe 3 years old, somewhere around there. And I'd look at the baby and I'd say, "Your daddy's no good, is he?" And 9 times out of 10, I'd get a no. Why? Because they understood what I was saying? No, because I was shaking my head no. And I'd get a no. Only one ever really put me down. Because I said, "Your daddy's no good, is he?" He said, "Yes." I said, "Well, what's he good for?" He said, "He's good for loving." So, I had great respect for that child. The truth of the matter is that the eye is probably the primary instrument of communication. And good body language, then, begins with eye contact. You may notice that when I teach this class or any class, I'm not looking back there somewhere. I'm not looking at the wall over here. Now, if I want you to think about Christ coming in glory, I may look up. And you may look up when I get there and look up, because you, hopefully you're going, you know, with flow. But ordinarily, I don't look off at the wall, maybe glance once in a while. But if you don't get eye contact with your class, then you're apt to lose that class. It's hard to convey your message. Now, that again means that you ought never to be so tied to your notes that you can't look up and look at your hearers. Or you only look up when you get to a pause in what you've been reading. You need to keep your eye on your class, because that is where the communications take place. I'll confess in this class, because it's not a Bible class, where I'm more familiar with the territory as far as the content is concerned. I've been more tied to notes than I ordinarily am, for which I apologize. But I'll just add to that then, do as I say and not as I do, at least in this class. If we're always looking down at our notes, what's the class going to see? They're going to see the top of our head. And that is not effective communication. And when you're looking at the class, include everybody. And it doesn't mean you have to just stare somebody in the eye the whole class. I mean, I could make Ray nervous. But it means that you scan and you go over everybody. But every once in a while, you do catch somebody in the eye and look at them specifically while you're talking, because that tells you I'm interested in you. It's better for the teacher to miss a phrase occasionally than it is, as I say, to show mainly the top of a head while reading most of the lesson. Scan the assembly. Pause briefly, as I say, on specific sets of eyes as points are made. Facial expression is a gesture. In fact, it may be one of your most effective gestures, because it seems to tell people whether you are sincere about what you're saying. Because if your body language and your face does not go with what you're saying, then they're probably going to conclude that you're not sincere about it. And unfortunately, a stone face very often will drag the voice down with it, because then you get a stone vocal preparation. It conveys really the message, you know, I really don't have any feeling in what I'm saying. And if you want to kill your audience, that will do it. Well, we associate our hands, don't we? Most often with gestures. But they're also the most troublesome sometimes, aren't they? Especially when we get up and start to teach. What do I do with these hands? Should I just let them hang at my side? Well, you know, if they just always are at your side and never moving, all you lack is the casket, because you're ready. I can't let them hang at my side. Oh, I know. I'll grip the lectern. Well, sometimes that works. That's not bad every once in a while to put your hands on the lectern. But, you know, you look like a statue. And that's not any good either. Well, I put them in my pockets. You know, I learned when I was just a kid, you don't put your hands in your pockets. My mama taught me that. And she said, in addition to that, when you get up in that pulpit, you empty those pockets. You know, some of us are licensed to carry. You don't want a pocket full of anything like that for several reasons. Among them, it's illegal to take it into a church building. But there are other reasons than that. But, you know, why are the hands such a problem? When you're just talking with somebody, do you worry? What do I do with my hands? Well, Adam, I won't talk to you. But I don't know what to do with my hands. No. You never think about it. You just naturally do it. So, you know, it's not that difficult a thing. It's difficult only because and when we make it difficult. And if we are in a one-on-one conversation where we are really involved and maybe it's on politics or something like that, and we've got some strong opinions and they've got some strong opinions, you can believe that those hands are going to be going. Because it is just natural. The thing to really avoid. I've known some folks who try to look holy. Don't stand up there with your hands clasped in front of your chest. Number one, it's not effective. And if you just keep them there forever, people are going to be thinking about that. And why is he doing that? More than they're going to be listening to what you say. Again, it gets the teacher in the way of the message. And how many of you ever had anything to grip in a one-on-one conversation? Something to take the place of the lectern. It's not there. So just, you know, you've got your Bible here. You've got your notes here. Use it for what it's supposed to be used for, but not as a crutch. Leave the hands free. If you want to, hold a Bible and keep it uppermost in the minds of the people that this is what we're here about. But don't worry about the hands otherwise. If you just let them go with the flow, they will go and they will go correctly. Planned gestures are very often more comedic than they are effective. You know, if you want to tell somebody, get out of here, it's simultaneous. You know what the comedian does? Get out of here. Well, what's funny about it? It's not timed right. Natural gestures are timed right. They are not planned. They're natural. The only thing I think you really need to be careful about is being sure that you don't gesture for every word and every syllable. But why? Because if we gesture for every word and every syllable, our audience is at least subliminally getting the message that every word and every syllable are of equal importance. So let it flow naturally in one-on-one conversation in the churchyard. You don't gesture on every word. So again, just that's the one thing I would have you watch for. All right, number three. What about the posture? Oh, now he's going to tell us how to stand. Well, it's important. Face your hearers squarely. You can't talk much to them like this. You need to be confronting them that way. If you've got an auditorium like ours, you need to turn that way. And you can't look at everybody without going from side to side. But when you're talking over here, face them. I'm not saying you can't just turn your head once in a while. Don't take it that far. Hold your head up. Chin level. Where you look. Just don't get it too high. Where people think you're talking down to them and you're being snooty. You may have seen people like that. I've seen a few. You just don't talk down to your hearers. If you want to lean a little, lean towards your audience. Because you're trying to communicate with them. Don't lean back from them. It looks like you're trying to get away from them. If you lean on the lectern for a little while, that may convey. And sometimes when I'm talking, I really want people to listen. I may get over a lectern like this and talk to them. But I don't stay there forever. Because I'm trying to communicate a specific thought. And when that's done, then I'm through leaning on the lectern. Don't let the lectern become a crutch unless you're a cripple. And I'm not talking about physical crippling. If you feel crippled as a teacher, then you may wind up just leaning on the lectern. If you have the luxury of a traveling microphone in the auditorium, for instance, teaching in there, then it's okay to move out from behind the lectern once in a while and get a little bit closer to your audience. I move sometimes from behind the lectern in here and from side to side. But you don't have to stand out there and walk aimlessly and purposelessly. Boy, that's a word, isn't it? In fact, I'm not sure it is a word. Let's just say without purpose. I know that one. Because sometimes moving out can remove a wall to the hearers. But most movement should occur in transitional points in the lesson. And not just be walking around all of the time for the sake of walking. It becomes distractional to me. Avoid making strong points while you're moving backward. If I've moved up here and then I want to come back and I start moving back and I'm making a strong point, what does that look like? That is no time to make a strong point. You are in a transitional stage, and you don't make strong points in transitional stages. Why? Because it is not possible. My personal opinion is that too much movement, swaying, or bobbing appears more as an eccentricity than it does a desire to get close to the hearers. I think it can be done way too much. Don't let concerns about your voice or your gestures or your posture turn you into a statue. Just strive to be natural. A little practice will help with that. It doesn't hurt to get in front of a mirror and go over your lesson, particularly as a beginning teacher, because you get used to things that way. And you can work at just letting the gestures flow and so forth. But proper preparation with a natural delivery will enable both the teacher and his hearers to look forward to the lesson. We've got one more lesson, and I'm going to stop right here. Because next Lord's Day, we're going to take the second half of this lesson on presentation, and we're going to bring this class to a close. I will be repeating some of the things next Sunday that I've said today, saying them in a little different way. The reason being that these are important things, because if the preparation and the presentation are not what they ought to be, then the Bible study cannot accomplish what it's supposed to accomplish. No way, no way is it going to do it. Now you say, well, I mean, we got through the class and I had a lot of class members come up and tell me good class. Don't believe everything you hear, folks. One of the greatest qualities, and I'll repeat this next Sunday too, one of the great qualities of most of our Bible classes is that the hearers are patient and kind. And that's never more apparent than when they walk out the door. Because it's just something you say. Well, good class, good sermon. If it ain't, see, I just broke a rule. We're going to talk about grammar next week. That's bad grammar. But every once in a while, you can break a rule because you're doing it for an effect. You've got to communicate with people. It is not difficult to do. It is easy to do, or at least with proper preparation and proper presentation, it will look easy. Doesn't it look easy when you watch NBA players play basketball? I could do that. Yeah, right. Golf. I mean, you know, it looks easy. But when you've worked hard enough and long enough, the day will come when for you it will be easier and easier and easier, and your classes will love you more and more and more, but more importantly, they will love the Lord more. And that is what it's all about. We'll see you next week, Lord willing.